Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be present, even if only online. And before I start, I do have to say that a week ago, the world has looked differently. We are talking about refugees and migrants. We are suddenly confronted with millions, probably millions, of refugees in Europe. The title of my talk is about Fortress Europe, so I will try to explicate a specific tension between inside and outside this so-called Fortress Europe. I also would like to use the words of several journalists and politicians which are surrounding us right now to just point to the notion of turning point. And I would like to ask the question also in my talk, are we at a turning point in the way we cope with refugees and we talk about refugees? So what I want to do today is first talk about the normalization of far-right agenda and rhetoric. This is my crucial and salient claim, which is going through the entire lecture, which is about the observation, which we have also examined in various studies, that the rhetoric of exclusion has become normalized. What do I mean with this? I will go into this later on, but just briefly, I mean that the rhetoric of exclusion, the hate speech, which has been presented so very well right now by my colleague, has become mainstream. And we have to investigate in which way and why this rhetoric of exclusion has become mainstream. I draw on many studies, which I will not be able to summarize all of them. I will give some examples. But I draw, first of all, on a study of all British national newspapers from 1996 to 2006, which we did in a quantitative and qualitative study. Secondly, on a study of 2015-16 in Austria, where, as you will well remember, the refugees from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan and Iran came into Europe, the big so-called refugee crisis. And thirdly, after 2016, that means after Brexit and Trump, where hate speech became especially normalized. And finally, I also did a study about migration and the COVID-19 crisis, specifically about the closing of borders. What I will talk about today is basically a summary of these studies, trying to find continuities and discontinuities. I will talk first about constructing borders inside, that means inside European nation states. And I will focus specifically on argumentation devices and legitimation strategies. Secondly, I will talk about what I call defending the homeland, German Heimat, and I will focus on conspiracy theories and the various metaphors accompanying migration processes. Finally, I will come to conclusions, challenges, and perspectives. So let me start again with the question, are we now at a Zeitenwende, a turning point? How do we confront borders yesterday and today? And specifically, I will look at and analyze the debates about saving children, especially unaccompanied children, as we were confronted with in Moria and Lesbos, in Afghanistan, and now, of course, across the Polish-Ukrainian border. If we look at the number of refugees, and I do prefer talking about refugees in my talk and not about migrants, although, of course, the boundaries are blurred, but there are different treaties and conventions which relate to these two categories of mobile people. 2021, 82 million people were refugees, inside countries and across borders. 42% of these refugees are less than 18 years old. And as you all know very well, we are all signatories, all our countries are signatories of the Child Convention, the Human Rights Charter, and so forth and so on. I don't have to repeat all this, especially also the Geneva Convention. And as you all know, there are big debates in Europe about what to do with refugees, which countries take which refugees. So the questions I have, which will guide me through my talk, are: why has it become normal? And of course, we can then debate in the discussion what normal means, for some EU member states to not save refugees, to protect oneself from refugees. Which refugees? Which refugees are, as one could say, allowed in, and which are not allowed in, and why? And how are these decisions legitimized? Which discursive strategies are used for legitimation? And how are they justified? And in this way, argumentation and legitimation strategies have to be taken together. And finally, which discursive shifts or frame shifts are taking place? Now, Professor Erro said there might be a difference between critical discourse studies and discourse studies, or let's say linguistics. I don't see these differences. My approach is the so-called discourse historical approach, which means I look at context-dependent discourse strands over time, and I do comparative research, which is very much also founded in interdisciplinary agenda. That means I am very problem-oriented and not so much oriented towards the linguistic devices as such. But you will see as I go through my talk how I operationalize these questions with the linguistic, syntactic, semantic, pragmatic taxonomies and categories. I'm specifically interested in politeness and impoliteness strategies, and I've worked together with my colleague at Lancaster, Jonathan Culpepper, in this specific area. So, first, I would like to emphasize that the hate speech, of course, is not new, and the hate speech has been already pub in the public sphere not so long ago. If we think of National Socialism and fascism and the rhetoric of exclusion. And much of this discourse is being drawn on again, sometimes explicitly and sometimes coded because of post-war taboos. My second claim in this specific context is that this coded discourse is vanishing and that it has become acceptable to be explicit in hate speech again. This relates to the rise of far-right populist parties globally, not just in Europe and in the US, but also elsewhere. But of course, in my book, Politics of Fear, I have been concerned specifically with the US and with Europe, including the UK, not just the EU, also Russia and Turkey and other countries. And the politics of fear, which either creates or instrumentalizes a crisis, excludes and defines a scapegoat. The scapegoat, which, as they claim, are a threat to us, thus fear is created, and they are discriminated against linguistically and also materially. And these parties then promise to, quote unquote, solve this problem. Thus, they become the saviors and the voice of the people in the sense of nativism, those who have always lived here, are born here, whose grandparents are born here, thus going back to a kind of Blut und Boden ideology. In this way, they create hope. And this was very well to be observed, of course, with Donald Trump. But the Americans didn't invent this kind of discursive pattern, because already both with Jean-Marie Le Pen or Jörg Haider or Salvini, who has been quoted already, and other leaders of far-right parties, we have come across this pattern many times. This pattern also includes appeals to common sense, to emotions, which has already been talked about, and not only hate, but also shame and anger, and most importantly, anti-intellectualism. Suddenly, facts are not important anymore. Opinions have become the ground of contestation. And in this way, I talk in my book about the arrogance of ignorance. The arrogance of ignorance supports both the turn, the emotional turn, and it supports the anti-fact, alternative fact, fake news turn. All of this leads to what I call shameless normalization. That means there is no apology anymore, and there is the possibility to say, quote unquote, what one always wanted to say, what one finally dares say, and in that way to swear, to offend, to abuse other people, especially those which are the scapegoats. So if we talk about migrants and refugees, who are those scapegoats? And in this context, the notion and concept of stranger becomes very important. I cannot summarize the most important book by Elias and Scottson about the strangers and the way those people who have always lived here always regard newcomers as strangers, even if they have the same language, religion, and citizenship. But if we look more broadly and historically, we first have to look at the Jews as the so-called modern strangers, as defined by Simmel or Sigmund Baumann or András Kovács, the strangers in our society, those who are different but not different enough, close and not distant. And the postmodern strangers, those, as Baumann says, who are deprived, weak, and destitute, a social renegotiated other, those who come to us alone, over many, many weeks, months, and years, over the sea and over the deserts. There, strangerhood is privatized. Identities are unstable and blurred. And Bauman concludes in his important work that there are two strategies to cope with strangers. Either we devour them, that means assimilate them, or we spit them out. We don't want them and send them back. And we are still confronted exactly with these tensions of assimilation and deportation. And in this context, racialization plays a big role, which is the process by which social space is negatively associated with various population groups. And this is what we currently are experiencing: migrants, refugees put in camps, between the borders in no man land, or allowed to cross the borders. And this is one of the questions we are asking ourselves: who is allowed to cross the borders? And why are unaccompanied children not allowed? So, to define shameless normalization, I define it in the following way: far-right populists' agendas and their rhetoric have reached the political mainstream. Many conservative parties have colonized these agendas. I speak from the Austrian experience. We see it in the British experience. I hope you will tell me about the French experience. We see it in the US American experience. The boundaries of what is sayable has been shifted. We have a tendency from coded discrimination to explicit discrimination. Traditional post-war values, norms, and rules of political culture as dialogue and negotiation, the Gricean maxims, are violated by continuous provocations. Please just think of Trump. And such provocations are scandalized, then disseminated via the media, supported by mainstream conservatives who want to win those votes, and thus normalized. And I will give you some examples of various, of the whole range of this kind of normalization. Importantly, is another dimension of normalization, which Wilhelm Heidmeier, a German sociologist, calls coarse incivility, rohe Bürgerlichkeit, soft discriminatory utterances, quasi-rational legitimation, which convey authoritarian attitudes between a thin layer of civilized polite manners by means of indirectness and implicitness. And in this way, pragmatics becomes salient. And of course, linguistic pragmatics becomes salient. This leads, Heidmeier concludes, to the normalization of discriminatory values. On the other hand, we also experience coarse incivility, how blatantly impolite discourses are used to shamelessly convey such values. And if you think of Trump's offense and insult of women, I don't think I have to explain much more. So, what are the functions, the manipulative and persuasive functions of exclusion? How does that work? First of all, and we already heard many examples, targeting groups as enemies and outsiders with the discursive strategies of naming and predication. The use of propaganda, which defines the enemy via metonymies and legitimation strategies, and also many fallacies like straw man arguments, hasty generalization, ad hominem, slippery slope, and so forth. Hate incitement, that means appeal to violence and hate. Conspiracy theories, which should actually be called narratives because they're not theories. The institutionalization, fourthly, of identification, isolation, and exclusion, that means already legislation, and finally, the racialization of space. So we can experience and observe a scale, starting with the nomination, the labeling, and going up to the closing in, the racialization in ghettos and camps. And of course, then deportation and so forth. In this way, we are dividing the world. And I was really happy to see the diagram of my colleague. Obviously, we think in quite similar ways. The far right is fighting because they are the victims and they have to fight the good fight against the others. We are the good, the true, the upright, the decent, the honest, the charismatic, the noble, brave, trustworthy, and incorruptible. And they are everything what we are not. They are the antagonists, deceitful, lazy, without conscience, evil, bad, cowardly, criminal. And we have to fight to defend ourselves and to protect ourselves. This is what we are being told, both by the far right and also by the national conservatives. There are three kinds of others. There are those up there. We have the elites, the politicians, the journalists, the intellectuals, and so forth. We have those out there, those outside, the asylum seekers, the so-called economic refugees, the welfare tourists, and so forth. There are very many labels. And we have those down there. Those are those who are work shy, the so-called spongers, and parasites, which already have been talked about. And if we imagine that we are confronted from three sides by the others, it is very plausible and persuasive that we are very threatened and have to defend ourselves. So if we have to defend ourselves, we have to legitimate and argue why we have to defend ourselves, in what way, especially in democracies. In authoritarian states, this is not necessary. And if we go back to various definitions of legitimation strategies, Luisa Rojo-Martin and Teun van Dijk, for example, say legitimation exists if a powerful group or institution, often the state, the government, the rulers, the elite, seeks normative approval for its policies or actions. It does so through strategies that aim to show that such actions are consistent with the moral order of society. That means we have to justify why we exclude people. And there are four dimensions of legitimation. Legitimation via authority, appealing to an authority. Legitimation via rationalization, appealing to numbers, statistics, etc. Legitimation via moral, we are appealing to certain values. And legitimation via mythopoiesis, we are appealing to certain experiences and historical comparisons. This is then obviously merged and combined with what we call topi. The topos, a specific warrant between claim and conclusion in an argumentation. And those topi, which we already find with Aristotle, however, Aristotle has both formal and content-oriented topi. I now present here some content-oriented topi, which we find in all our studies about migrants and refugees and the rhetoric of exclusion. These are the justification which only have to be hinted at, and in the common ground, in the common knowledge, in the endoxa, people know, and it doesn't have to be explained. For example, the topos of burden, providing for so many refugees, places an inordinate burden on Austrians. Therefore, Austria should only accept a limited number. The topos of culture, which is prevalent. The people arriving now are mostly uneducated or illiterate. Therefore, they are an unacceptable burden on the welfare state. Or the topos of male nature and culture. The people arriving now are mostly young men who cannot experience restraint. Therefore, they are a danger to Austrian women. The topos of historical dissimilarity. The Geneva Convention was designed for a different historical situation. Therefore, Austria, and of course, you could also substitute France or Poland or any other country, is not bound by it. And if the EU does not control its external borders, Austria must take national measures, the topos of national responsibility. And finally, the topos also of threat. Some of the people arriving now are, may in the future commit acts of terrorism. Therefore, Austria should close its borders and police them strictly. And of course, there are many more, but these are universally to be found topi and warrants in argumentation schemes, which we all detected in our four studies, which I mentioned at the outset. I want to give you an example of the British tabloids, and this is not one special example where I looked for those examples for a long time. You can find them every day. British tabloids are something very special, and you find all these topi, which I just mentioned, in the headlines. 4,000 murderers and rapists we can't throw out. Topos of danger. Migrants shun the English language. Topos of culture. 500,000 migrants get social housing instead of our people. The topos of national responsibility. Or migrants set to flood in. The metaphor, the invasion by migrants. And so forth and so on. This, of course, the confrontation with tabloid democracies, which we all live in, disseminates these attitudes and stereotypes daily, as well as the social media, of course, which was already talked about. And it's therefore no surprise that the common ground and the common sense has been influenced by these opinions. I also want to show you the use of euphemisms, which is part of the coarse civility. That means non-explicit. 2018 in Austria, as you might know, we had a national conservative and far-right coalition, and the arrival centers for refugees, the camps when they arrive in Austria, were suddenly renamed as departure centers, which caused a big scandal. It was a provocation, of course. Now, what does it mean if you relabel and recontextualize arrival centers as departure centers? It means we don't want you here, because if you arrive and you see the name of departure center, that means you should go again. And there is, of course, another step in between, which is detention centers. So, especially in Austria, the collective memory of Nazi times is not far away. And these labels all can be etymologically taken back to specific terms which are were used in Nazi time, as Viktor Klemperer has listed in his famous book Lingua Terti Imperii. Interestingly, and this is what I want to show you now about the normalization, 2020, that means 2 years ago, where we have now a new government consisting of National Conservative and Green Party, The arrival centers were not named back into arrival centers, but in return centers. So return is viewed as softer as departure centers, as even a more civilized notion, but basically the meaning remains. You don't arrive, you arrive and should return. A paradox nomination. I want to come to my second example, which is the borders and the the refugees, the others coming from outside. And here I want to refer to a very important, I believe, notion of the moralization of borders by Bastian Vollmer, a German colleague in Münster, who wrote an excellent book about borders and the rhetoric of exclusion. And he says this exclusionary practice, closing of borders, has been morally legitimized, and here you have one of the strategies, over the years by an array of policy frames, but also by a narrative of deservingness. That is, by following the principle that some people do not deserve to be treated equally or in the way we, the host society, treat human beings. That means some migrants and refugees are privileged and we let them in, and others we don't. And we still have to ask, why not unaccompanied children? So if we discursively construct the stranger, we are confronting several metaphorical threat scenarios, as Andreas Musolf has labeled these. Some of them were already mentioned by my colleague. War, refugees, migrants are invading us. We are the victims. Floods, waves, natural catastrophe, where we are helpless. We cannot defend ourselves. A tsunami, an apocalypse, the decline. We are dying out, which already leads us to replacement theory. And the virus and parasites rhetoric, which certainly goes back to the 19th century and to the beginning of nationalism, and was specifically emphasized in fascism and national socialism. So these metaphors accompany and as frames are the strangers. And here I want to show you how the anti-Semitic stereotypes, which are prevalent for in the Eastern Europe, especially in Poland and also in Russia, how anti-Muslim stereotypes are building on anti-Semitic stereotypes. Here you have a famous cover of a weekly, Busieci, from 2016, from our study about the so-called refugee crisis, the Islamic rape of Europe. And here you have the men violating physically the female body, the nation, Europe and Poland, dark and light. And this is a motif, a trope, which we have confronted in anti-Semitic images as well. I cannot talk about my research on anti-Semitism, but I'm happy to answer some questions about that later on. And Mr. Kaczynski, 2016, during this crisis, talked about the various diseases which are going to fall into Poland if we let those Muslim refugees in, where he said in a speech, there are already symptoms of very dangerous diseases not seen in Europe for a long time, cholera on the Greek islands, dysentery in Vienna. Some are saying there are also other, even more serious diseases. There are various types of parasites and protozoans, which are not dangerous to those people, but can be dangerous here. Again, you have the here and there, the us and them. It is not about discriminating against anybody, which is a disclaimer, we call that in linguistics, but all these needs to be checked. It needs to be checked. And hence, the Minister of Health should clarify how this looks at the moment, what our activists know. It all looks very bad. You can look at the specific YouTube and also look at this speech. And here you say a revival of the rhetoric about parasites and viruses and diseases now used against Muslim refugees coming from Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, but also from African countries, but which we know were previously used against Jews. And of course, looking at the world conspiracy narratives, we now find a combination of anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic stereotypes in the so-called Feindbild, enemy image of George Soros, in Austria, in Poland, in Russia, in the US, in Italy, in the UK. I call this the Judeus ex machina strategy, which means this is a strategy which allows blaming an imagined homogeneous collective of Jews for whatever issue might seem opportune for political ends. Whenever a scapegoat is looked for, Jews might be the first to be nominated. Here we see one of many caricatures by the far-right caricaturist Ben Garrison. And of course, we have to look at visual hate speech as well, very explicit, where we see many elements in the multimodality of this image, starting with the labeling of the boat, with the dollar sign, with the enormous head, and out of the mouth come the Mexican migrants into the US, which is obviously and allegedly seen as the land of free stuff, pushing down the American who still holds up the flag. And this is also a worship that means Soros, the Jews, the world conspiracy is very, very powerful. And Soros brings the refugees and migrants both to the US and, as Viktor Orban repeatedly said, to Hungary as well. That means we have a combination of the powerful, allegedly powerful Jewish world conspiracy with anti-Muslim and anti-migrant sentiments. This was explicit. Here now again, like the euphemisms, a more implicit way of the rhetoric of exclusion, because it has to be acceptable to the mainstream. Our former Chancellor Sebastian Kurz said 2016, it is understandable that many politicians are afraid of ugly pictures of border security. But we cannot transfer this job to Turkey because we don't want to get our hands dirty. It won't go without ugly pictures. This is the topos of reality. We, as the reality is as it is, we have to confront it, which is fallacious in this case, because of course people don't have to drown. This is not a fact. They are left to drown. But such utterances that one would like to help, but one cannot help, and that we have to become used to ugly pictures, has become quite prevalent in public discourse as legitimation for a rhetoric of exclusion. I come to the end, and I would like to first show what I mean again with shameless normalization and normalization. certain utterances, terminology, label, policy propositions, arguments start at the fringe, in the margins, in the far right, with whatever party in that country, be it Jobbik, Fidesz, the Austrian Freedom Party, the Sweden Democrats, the Rassemblement National, or UKIP, or the Lega. And these expressions are recontextualized and resemioticized from the backstage to the front stage, over tabloids, over the media, over online postings, over news, interviews, provocations, scandalizations, and in that way they are disseminated into different genres, from interviews to speeches, posters, up to legislation, textbooks, and rulings, and from the social media and the tabloids to the traditional quality media, politics, public sphere, legislation, and then ending with education. And in this way, we can follow the trajectory of certain terms and concepts of the far right, of that hate speech, of the rhetoric of exclusion, in from the margins to the center. This we have done with many instances, with certain notions. One very famous notion is in German, Integrationsunwilligkeit, in English, the unwillingness to integrate, which was always claimed by the far right and now has become part and parcel of legislation. So to sum up, what does normalization in this context mean? I call it driving on the right. First of all, drawing on collective memories, on common sense, on the common ground, and in doxa on the one hand, and the collective amnesia, forgetting what hate speech has actually implied in other times, not so long ago, on the other hand. There is a huge loss of trust and dissatisfaction, which leads to much anger, and then to resentment and hate and shamelessness, also due to the rise of inequality. As third and important factor in our context of refugees and migrants, we encounter the moralization of borders. Who are neighbors and who are not neighbors? Who's allowed in and who's not allowed in? And which criteria are used to legitimize the opening or closing of borders? And here we have securitization and economization as two tendencies which are very important. Refugees dehumanized as commodities, how many can we take or where the boat is full? And the protection of the national, frequently female body. And finally, the culturalization of exclusion. What does that mean? A focus on symbolic politics, that means on the headscarf, on certain cultural moments, although primarily it's the question about resources and who gets which resources. The so-called Judaeus ex machina strategy, which I explained, and the phenomenon of tabloid democracy, that means scandalization and provocation sell. Thus, summarizing, tensions between globalizing economic, social, and cultural developments and exclusionary identity politics lead to reinventing nationalism, drawing on past nativist ideologies, and leading to inclusion and exclusion due to whoever is allowed in or not allowed in. Thank you very much.